Milwaukee. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up in about 60 seconds. We talk about the world of sports, the world of politics, and the clear and sometimes unexpected ways in which those two worlds often intersect and play off of one another and feed the passions of each other. And it has been so down through history. It is not a new phenomenon, although maybe the way in which this intersection of sports and politics perhaps plays out a little bit differently now than it once did. That's one of the things that makes this new book by Roger Abrams so very, very interesting. Playing Tough, The World of Sports and Politics. And some of what he looks at are very contemporary issues and situations, and some of them take us back to ancient times. And I really appreciate the long historic view which the author takes. Roger Abrams is Richardson Professor of Law at Northeastern University and has written extensively in the field of sports law. Among his credits, Sports Justice, The Law and the Business of Sports, Legal Bases, Baseball and the Law, and the First World Series and the Baseball Fanatics of 1903. Again, this new book is called Playing Tough, The World of Sports and Politics. And Professor Roger Abrams, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. You know, I had to write that book about the 1903 World Series because as I would walk from my office at Northeastern to the T station, there's a big plaque on one of the university's gymnasiums, and it says, on this site in 1903 was held the first World Series. Northeastern used to be the home of the Boston American League baseball franchise. And so there was no choice in the matter. I had to find out what was going on in 1903, both in the city of Boston and on what is now the Northeastern campus.
Very good. How about you personally, ahead of that plaque, what was, for instance, the world of sports something that was of personal interest to you? Or did you come to enjoy it and be interested in it for other reasons?
Well, most people growing up in this country, and I think around the world, cannot avoid sports. Whether you like them or not, they are ubiquitous. They're around us in everything we do. There's a section in our newspaper called sports. There isn't a section in the newspaper called milk or concrete. It's sports. It fills our media and our television. And so, like anyone growing up in the 1950s, I played sports and never quite played well enough to make it a living. But I found a way around it. Mm. Becoming an academic, about 20 years into my career as an academic, I decided that there was in the business of sports a microcosm of the kinds of legal issues that lawyers were going to face. No, they may not represent the Milwaukee Brewers, but they would certainly be involved in issues of contract and tort and criminal law and antitrust and labor law. And so I found through sports a way to teach my students about those other subjects. Sports becomes the hook to command their attention. Mm. And that's really what I've tried to do with these books. In this book, we're talking politics. We're talking political theory. We're talking things that otherwise would be in a book and no one would possibly pick up the book. But if it deals with the Olympics or with boxing or with soccer or rugby, people will use my book as a way to learn more about, for example, the way we govern ourselves, how our local governments make decisions to use hundreds of millions of dollars of tax dollars in order to finance local stadiums. Those are the important issues. Sports is just the frosting on the cake. Mm.
You know, that's a very, very apt way of describing your book. When I first picked it up, I almost never start a book from the beginning. I almost always just open it up someplace right in the middle and just dive in to just get a feel for it. And I happened to find a moment where you went on for several paragraphs not talking about sports at all. I don't remember what the particular chapter was, but I remember thinking, where's the sports in this? And then, of course, the sports gets ushered in. And as I ultimately read the book, I loved that balance and the fact that, as you say, the main thing about this book is politics, sociology, history of our country and other countries, and woven in are fascinating insights involving sports and how it was in the arenas of sports that many of these political realities were played out.
Absolutely. And as you said, it goes back a long way. The earliest I could find this relationship was during the years of the Roman Republic, before the emperors took over, when you ran for election, and in fact there was something like Greek democracy during that time, the way you campaigned is you put on sporting games for the voting public. And if you put on the best set of sporting games, you'd be elected consul for a year, based on the quality of your sports, and so it does go back, but you can find it in today's newspaper about how sports and politics interrelate.
We're speaking with Roger Abrams about his book "Playing Tough: The World of Sports and Politics." I really appreciated at one point in the book when you create something of a distinction between two terms that we're probably a bit too sloppy with, namely play and sports.
Yes.
And the fact that there is a connotation about play that does not necessarily match with the reality of the way sports are often played.
Is true. Play is inherent in human beings, and sport has has an organized aspect to it, some regularization of rules, and then, of course, grows into this huge business, this international business. One doesn't normally think of play in those terms. It becomes an opportunity for us to vicariously be involved in this athletic activity as spectators. The teams become our teams. We walk around the city wearing the uniforms of these teams. We don't do that with regard to play, but sports really reflects what we are as a country and what we are as a world, both for good and for bad. I try to make that very clear in the book, that sports are not good, sports are not bad, but sports are, and it's something that you have to deal with.
Well, and it sounds like I'm creating a poor name for a new store, but in a sense, sports are us.
That's true.
I mean, they are a reflection of who we are as people. And somewhere,
that's right, but if you put the R backwards, you'll probably have a copyright violation.
Right, right. And at some point in the introduction to the book, I think I don't remember if it's a way you have of observing this or someone you're quoting, but you point out the fact that when the Brewers have just won, or the Packers have just won, or the Bears or the Blackhawks or whoever it might be, people are not out in the streets chanting, "They're number one." They're chanting, "We're number one. We take ownership of those kind of victories. They are our victories, not just the victory of the team that happens to be headquartered in the city where we live."
And I can't imagine what's going to happen when eventually the Cubs win. And that will happen. Maybe not in our lifetimes, but that will happen. Those of us who live in Boston, of course, suffered with the 86 years between World Series victories for the Red Sox. I was giving a speech at a library in South Boston a good number of years ago, and the back of the room was filled with very, very senior men. And after the speech was over, I went over to them, thanked them for coming, and asked if there were any questions that they could that I could answer. And their comment to me was, "We're just hanging on." And I knew exactly what they were talking about. They were just hanging on until the Red Sox won. And I didn't take their names and check whether in fact they did pass away, but I'm sure winning the World Series resulted in a lot of very happy people.
Yeah,
towards the end of their lives.
I think one of the most powerful experiences I've ever had that you're just now describing is when I lived in Chicago for a couple of years in the mid '80s. So I was living in Chicago the year that the Bears won the Super Bowl with Refrigerator Perry and so on. And I was at someone's apartment, someone in the church choir I sang in, and to watch the Super Bowl together. And I'll never forget the moment when the game is won, how a couple of the biggest, burliest guys in this church choir ran out onto the balcony of this apartment and just screamed and whooped at the top of their lungs. And you could hear other people from other apartments similarly screaming. And I mean, I was glad the Bears won, but not in the way that they were glad the Bears won. And I'd never really seen up close that kind of visceral thrill that is involved when a team to which you are so devoted and for whom you have waited so long for that breakthrough to occur finally achieve the pinnacle of that particular sport. It's something I'll never forget.
And even though I've written 6 books on sports and something else, I still haven't figured that out. I don't know what it is that motivates us. I can describe the behavior, just like you did and just like I did, as to how people react to sports. We can talk about the fact that these are basic human instincts. Sport was the way we prepared for the hunt when we needed to hunt instead of just go to the local grocery store to get dinner. You would play sports as a way to enhance your eye-hand coordination. So we know there's something basically human about it. There is also senses of community, but you know, frankly, I have gone to hear the magnificent Boston Symphony and not run out on Huntington Avenue after the concert screaming about how wonderful that was, even though, of course, it was. It was wonderful. Sports just twists us and turns us and controls us, and apparently we love it.
When it gets to the matter of sports and politics intersecting, you touch on this in all kinds of fascinating ways, and we'll dig into a couple of these specific stories in some detail. But I actually want to jump towards the end of the book, the chapter which is titled Hardball in City Hall, in which you talk about this really difficult question of the public financing of sports stadiums and the way in which that plays out. At one point, you write in this chapter, as we have seen, governments have always used sports as a tool of social control and public amusement. To maintain political power, politicians have looked to these games as instruments to be manipulated for strategic advantage and prestige. And you say, you immediately give an example which takes us back to the second century. I mean, because when we first read those words, we think of that as a very modern phenomenon. But yes. Part of what your book is saying is that how this plays out now, it has always played out, at least to some extent, in the same way.
That is true. What I still don't understand is why sports has such political value within, for example, the municipality. There were ways for example, our nation's capital, for Washington, to have constructed a stadium so as to attract the major league team at far lower costs. But they used limited resources, obviously Washington, as all major cities have limited resources, in order to spend well over $600 million on this stadium. It's a terrific stadium. I've been there many times. I love the stadium. It obviously has political power. It has, I think in the book I refer to it as political currency, that, you know, if you lost anything other than one of your sports teams to another city, well, you may lose some jobs, but you're not. The only way you're going to lose an election is if you let the Baltimore Colts go to Indianapolis. Hmm.
You point out in this section, which talks about entrepreneurs dipping into these public resources, often for their own benefit, as you kind of tell the story of how this evolves, you point out something which I'm afraid I didn't know till I read your book, namely how Milwaukee is an important moment in this history at the very, very start of it, back in the 1950s. I'm sure a lot of our listeners knew this, but even though I didn't. But sketch out how Milwaukee plays into this story.
Well, Milwaukee built the Milwaukee County Stadium. The original intention was that it would be for a minor league franchise of the Boston Braves. And by the time it was completed, the Boston Braves said, you know, that's a good stadium in a wonderful market. We're going to go to Milwaukee and let our minor league team go somewhere else. And in fact, that's how Milwaukee became a major league city when it comes to baseball. It's always been a major league city when it comes to something else. But with regard to baseball, they attracted the Braves. Except, of course, that the Braves had found that they can put everything on a truck and go somewhere else, which of course they did, to Atlanta. But it was public financing that did it. And if I recall correctly, Milwaukee was the leader when it came to public financing. This was the first instance. But it's never enough for the entrepreneurs. They will always find something else that has to be done to the stadium, some other concession that has to be made. But I guess that's capitalism. Normally, you would see it as having the fans as your customers and being able to have their prices of admission support your enterprise. But I guess the municipalities, the counties, the states are also the financial supporters of these enterprises.
Hmm. You point out something interesting about this story, too. Again, Milwaukee being the first publicly funded field for baseball. You say that the Braves moved to Milwaukee in 1953, the St. Louis Browns has moved the following year to Baltimore when they became the Orioles. In your words, altered the public's perception of who really owns and controls major league franchises. I suppose up until then, people in a sense could have kind of a naive, unsophisticated view of that, and this sort of jolted them to an awareness of the reality of it.
It's true. For a half century, for 50 years, the 16 teams that made up organized baseball had always stayed in the same locality. They might move to a better stadium within that locality. Obviously, they did that in Pittsburgh and in other places. But baseball, much more than later, belonged to a geographic region or even a city. With the movement of the Boston Braves and the St. Louis Browns, and then of course the traumatic movement of the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Giants to the West Coast, and all the other moves that have followed in the four major sports, we realize that when we root for the local team, we're just rooting for those who are temporarily visiting, and the players, of course, get into the act with free agency, and so we end up really rooting for the laundry that they're wearing. We like that uniform. Go Red Sox uniforms, which is basically it, because the team turns over every couple of years.
We're speaking with Roger Abrams about his book, Playing Tough, The World of Sports and Politics. I especially loved chapter one of your book, Early Baseball and the Urban Political Machine, in part because I didn't know enough about the early history of baseball in our country, and because I really didn't know enough about Tammany Hall. Which, of course, I mean, most people at least sort of recognize the name from American history as one of the paramount examples of political corruption in early America, thanks to the diligent work of one William McGeer Tweed. And I certainly, before reading your book, did not know anything about the connection between Mr. Tweed, Tammany Hall, and early baseball. How did you first come across this connection? I mean, not that it's something completely obscure that you yourself uncovered, but I mean, is this something you've known about for a long, long time?
Well, I learned about the growth of the so-called amateur New York clubs, starting, of course, with the Knickerbockers in the 1840s, and then a whole series of clubs that were based on social and fraternal organizations and work-related organizations. I knew about that relationship. And in some earlier work that I had done, I had learned about Tammany Hall, both its good and its bad. What was happening in New York was this explosion in population, and without a commensurate increase in local government to provide services for the enormous numbers of immigrants who came to New York. And Tammany Hall played that role as a social service agency in exchange, of course, for votes. In fact, one person could vote two or three times, just shave off the mustache and then shave off the beard and then get a haircut, and you'd go to another place and you would vote again. What I was searching for was some relationship to the topic of this book, which was sports, politics. Tammany Hall had right up to the top of the building. The sport information came from a secondary reference to the effect that there were politicians who were on the boards of directors of these social clubs that played baseball. And so I was able to trace down who these politicians were. And finally, a small part of the long story of Boss Tweed, there was reference to his support of his own baseball club by, of course, finding jobs for these men in the sanitation department of the city of New York, jobs for which they did not have to do any work. And so they were full-time employees who could spend all of their time playing baseball, and they did that very well. Tweed was a master in knowing how to win the affection of the political groups he needed in order to maintain his rule and to wring the city dry, which he did. But of course, the story ends well. The New York Times nails him. When the stories came out, he eventually ends up spending the rest of his life in jail. The baseball club, however, continues and becomes the New York Giants in the first National League season in 1876.
You, by the way, clarify something that is namely the myth surrounding the creation of baseball and disassociate it from Mr. Doubleday and give proper credit to a number of different people who probably most deserve credit, and for an organization, the Knickerbockers, that are probably largely forgotten today, but who played an important part in this story.
Well, these in the 1840s in New York, you had a lot of young men who had come to this country to make their fortune, or at least get off the farm, and people who had come to the city off the countryside, and they were basically, I guess we would call them white-collar workers. They didn't work in factories. There were there wasn't huge manufacturing at the time. They worked in offices, and they needed exercise, and they also needed some sort of a social atmosphere. So they formed these social clubs, the Knickerbockers being the foremost. And there were hundreds and hundreds of young men who joined the Knickerbockers, and they needed to exercise. And they did that in an area of down by the Battery of New York, which was then called Madison Square. Madison Square, the name moved north to become Madison Square Garden, as we know it now, and in the 35th Street in New York. But the railroads needed to take over Madison Square because they were expanding, and so the Knickerbockers would take the ferry over to the heights of Hoboken and play on a field, a park that was set aside there, called, and the name is wonderful, called the Elysian Fields. It was the way to Nirvana. And they needed some sort of organization. I mean, these were people who were organization men. They lived by the clock. They followed rules. They created a committee headed by various people who played various influences, and they wrote a set of rules. If you look at those rules, and I teach those rules to my students, they created, on paper, baseball, something that we would recognize today as baseball, and then played the first game in June of 1846 against former members of the Knickerbocker Club. The Knickerbockers and all these other clubs would rank their members in terms of their proficiency on the field of play. The first nine, and you would only need nine players, would have challenge matches against other social clubs. There would be a second nine and a third nine. And then, of course, the worst players were put into a group that were referred to as muffins. And these, these muffins could barely play the game, but they found the competition. And in this sport, the Knickerbockers found comradeship, competition, which is very American, and after every game, a sumptuous dinner. In fact, in reading the tales of the Knickerbockers, I wondered whether the main purpose for the activity was just to have the good dinner.
And, of course, this chapter traces the development of baseball away from localism and pride of community and fellowship and being in shape to a much more focused concern for victory and excellence.
Yes.
And, of course, this culminates ultimately in the Mutuals. And this is what takes us back most directly to Tammany Hall.
That is correct. And the important thing was to win. And when you won these games, what they would do is they would take the baseball that was used and they would gild it. And if you go to the Hall of Fame, something I recommend in Cooperstown, they have a lot of these golden gilded balls that were the victors' spoils. But they also got a very nice write-up in the local newspaper, which was also quite important.
Right. And I really appreciated in the course of this chapter when you mention, almost in passing, President Andrew Johnson attending a baseball game. And we just don't think about that, about the possibility of our 17th president attending a baseball game.
And, well, we probably all thought he was worried about being impeached, but you know, which he almost was. But he brought visiting baseball clubs to the White House and greeted them there in the White House. And so now, when we see President Obama bringing the victors in any sport or the college victors from the NCAA to the White House, that is a very long tradition. That is 150 years worth of using the White House as a platform for showing the importance of sport to all Americans.
Hmm. Speaking of platforms, the second chapter of your book underscores the enormous importance attached to the 1936 Olympic Games in Berlin. And you make an observation very close to the beginning of this chapter, which is so important, namely that history is written by the victors, and that when Americans look back at what happened at the 36 Olympics, we almost always look back through a very cloudy, biased lens and do not, in fact, understand what happened in Berlin.
It was a brilliant political move by Hitler, who needed more time in order to prepare for what was his clear plan, and that was to conquer the world. He needed to ease the concerns of the publics in the various countries that could stop him early on when he could have been stopped. And so he proceeded to hold these games, showing how the Nazis could organize things. And, in fact, they did organize it. It was a brilliant success. The one thing that we, of course, remember about those games was the success of Jesse Owens, the son of a black sharecropper who wins 4 gold medals at the games. We ignore the fact that the German team won many more gold medals than the American team, but it was for a brief moment, a time when the world came to Berlin and the Nazis put on a show, and that show convinced some people, certainly Avery Brundage, who was the head of the U.S. Olympic Committee, that, you know, these Nazis, they're not that bad. It would it would just take a matter of 3 years before we realized, yes, indeed, they were that bad.
Mm. I never had heard until I read your book that, well, I mean, I learned a lot about these Berlin Olympics. I, like a lot of Americans, suffered under the same misunderstandings. So I learned a lot. I'm so glad to have all of this clarification. I absolutely had never heard before what you tell us about Adolf Hitler's initial disinterest in the Olympics.
Yes. You know, it was. If you read Mein Kampf, and I don't recommend it, it's a little tough going. But if you read Mein Kampf, Hitler makes very plain that the what were called the German Vereins, the social clubs in Germany, should be the basis for in effect intramural sport among Aryans. Maybe he realized that non-Aryans could play these games better, but let's assume that was simply another one of his distorted views. But Goebbels understood that the way to show the world that the Nazis were just kind of ordinary people was to take over the Olympics. The Olympics had originally been awarded by the International Olympic Committee to the Weimar Republic as a demonstration of the fact that democracy had come to Germany. And then by the time the Olympics showed up, Hitler was well ensconced and well on his way to changing the world.
One thing I appreciated also about this chapter is how you give us a little bit of a history of the creation of the modern Olympics by Baron de Coubertin, and how he, in a sense, was rewriting the Olympics in not exactly his own image, but as he wanted them to be created. I mean, supposedly he was recreating the ancient games as they had occurred. You help us understand that, in fact, the modern Olympics are a rather drastic shift away from at least the rhetoric with which they were created.
Yes, Coubertin was sure that those ancient Olympic athletes were all virtuous amateurs. The truth is, could be nothing more extremely opposite. These were paid athletes in the ancient Olympics, paid by their city-states to participate. I tell one story I was able to find about one of those athletes changing his city-state affiliation. He was a free agent who changed. I'm no longer in this city. I'm going to be in this city at the next Olympics. But it was really Coubertin's Victorian ethos, this elitism of the upper classes that infused his vision of what the modern Olympics should be. Of course, no one could afford to work for a living and then prepare for the Olympics. You couldn't do them both. He was limiting the Olympics only to the upper class, which worked for a little while. At the first Olympics, our rowing team came from undergraduates at Harvard. They could do that because that's where they had prepared for to do their sport. But slowly, those ideas, and they were only ideas because they had no reality based on the history, changed. Until now, all the Olympics are participated in by professionals. But de Coubertin really did a remarkable thing, bringing the world together and creating an institution that was independent of any of the constituent countries. That is, if someone from France was on the International Olympic Committee. He was not on the committee as the representative of France. In fact, he was a delegate from the International Olympic Committee to France. And so Coubertin's concept was this was an independent world voice. And in some ways, and though I don't talk about it in the book, I can see this as a progenitor of the League of Nations or the United Nations, that it's something above and different from France and Germany and Italy and England, which he didn't particularly like. On the other hand, he insisted that the athletes come as part of country units. It was not a gathering of the best athletes in the world. It was a gathering of the best athletes from each of the member states of the Olympic movement.
And you tell us that he played at least a small role. It's one of the last things he did not long before his death in helping to ensure that a boycott would not occur of those crucial 36 Olympic Games in Berlin.
He did. Well, he also needed some money at the end of his life, and he was paid off, and he was received a promise that while his body may be buried somewhere, his heart would be buried in the ancient fields of Olympia in Greece. Strange stories.
If only he would record a message of endorsement for the organizers of the Berlin Olympic Games.
That's correct.
It's fascinating postscript to his very interesting story. And, of course, tied up into the Berlin Olympics is also a story that is somewhat similar, playing out at almost exactly the same time, namely the titanic boxing struggles between Joe Louis and Max Schmeling. And one of the things you tell us...
Mm-hmm. Right, you can't fully appreciate today how important boxing was at the time. In America, it was really second only to baseball, which was the only team sport that was viable in the 1930s. And the story of this first bout in 1936 was front page material across the whole globe. It was carried live by German radio at 3 a.m. in Berlin. And of course, Schmeling wins in an enormous upset. And it takes Louis 2 years to seek revenge. And he does in a spectacular way in the same place, in the squared circle in the center of Yankee Stadium before a sellout crowd, knocking out Schmeling in the first round. In 1938, the people of the Western countries needed some sort of victory over the Nazis. And while Schmeling was not a member of the Nazi Party, he was certainly their adopted child, and he never let the world know that he didn't agree with them and just took their plaudits while he won. And when he lost, he was brought into the German army.
What is interesting as you open this chapter is you try to help us understand that the way these battles were portrayed, the polarity between black versus white and good versus evil, depending on which side of this divide you were on, so simplistic, and that the closer you look at both of these men, the more one realizes that in no way reflected really who Joe Louis was, who Max Schmeling was.
That is true. But, it's a perfect example of how we simplify when it comes to politics. We vote, and sometimes vote, or actually sometimes vote, but when we vote, it's our person is good and the person on the other side is bad. And the person on the other side is never all bad, but certainly in part bad, at least sufficient to help us make our decision. These are complex characters who play their role. Each of the chapters of the book, I think, are worth a book on their own in order to delve more into it. But the design was to be suggestive, to get people to think a bit about how we go about portraying, for example, good and evil.
Mm, absolutely. And you're right in that the simplistic way in which we think us and them in the world of politics is very much reflected in the world of sports. And indeed, your book covers this topic in all kinds of different interesting ways. I just want to briefly mention that another exceptionally interesting chapter is the one you devote to South Africa and Nelson Mandela and the way in which rugby is used in a very, very powerful fashion. And many of us who saw the marvelous film Invictus know something about it, but as we read your book, we learn still more. Does knowing all the...
It's just a remarkable story of the greatest peaceful revolutionary of the 20th century.
And the way in which he knew sports could help cement the breakthroughs which had occurred in South Africa.
He did. And it was not an easy thing to do to convince the African National Congress that everyone was going to wear the green uniform of the Springboks in order to bring the Afrikaners over to the side of this multiracial democracy. But he did it.
In our last minute, has investigating this connection through so much of your life, has it tainted your capacity to enjoy sports on a surface level, knowing that there are always these undercurrents just beneath the surface?
No, I distinguish between my work as a scholar and my work as a fan. I'm looking forward to Stanley Cup and basketball and baseball and of course, in just a little bit of time, we're going to have summer camps and football. It's time to get out my cheese head one more time. You can draw those distinctions. While there are times when I'm much more interested in the business aspect, in the social aspect. I'll go to Fenway Park and I'll look around and see who is there, who is spending their life fortune in order to buy these tickets. But at the same time, when the Red Sox come back to win, I'm on my feet cheering.
Mm. The book is Playing Tough, The World of Sports and Politics, published by Northeastern University Press. Professor Roger Abrams, thank you so much for writing this fantastic book and for joining me today on The Morning Show. I'm so glad we had this conversation.
It was my pleasure.
Now 8:58, 2 minutes before 9 o'clock. At 9 o'clock, we'll join Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming. Right now, let's check the WGTD weekend forecast from the National Weather Service. Today, sunny, breezy, and hot. A high today of 87. Normal high this time of year would be 80. The record high for this date, we hit 98 degrees, July the 31st, 2006. Tonight now, a clear sky, mild conditions, overnight low 60. Saturday, sunny and 85. Sunday, partly sunny, 30% chance of rain. Sunday's high heading for 82. We got time here to take a sneak peek at the week ahead of us. Monday, sunny and 86. Tuesday, sunny and 78. Wednesday and Thursday, partly sunny, slight chance of rain both days. Temperatures in the mid-70s. Here are the current statistics. Humidity 73%. Very nice morning. Nothing wrong with this one. Sunshine was 73 degrees in Racine, 70 right now in Kenosha, 71 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, 74 in Milwaukee. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, NPR News and Classical Music on your gateway to public radio, just about 9 o'clock. Classical Music up next from Wisconsin Public Radio.